Trump is looking for greater leverage, the argument goes, and here's Huawei.
A pause on the tech offensive against Huawei. It's Wednesday, May 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a New Zealand mine disaster revisited, a challenge to the balance of power. China has new coffee and American luxury cars. Smart stormwater, different lunar looks. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States is delaying restrictions on U.S. technology sales to Chinese tech powerhouse Huawei in what it calls an effort to ease the blow on owners of its cell phones and smaller U.S. telecom providers that rely on its networking equipment. The Trump administration insists the sanctions are unrelated to its escalating trade war with China, and many analysts see it as aimed at pressuring U.S. allies in Europe to accede to Washington's entreaties to exclude Huawei equipment from their next-generation wireless networks known as 5G. The U.S. government says that the ban on selling technology to Huawei, the world's biggest maker of mobile network gear and the number two smartphone brand, will be delayed by 90 days. Shares in tech companies rose Tuesday on that news. The United States claims Huawei is a cybersecurity risk and has targeted it against the backdrop of a wider battle with China over economic and technological preeminence that has included tariffs on billions worth of trade and limits on business. Michael Swain is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked him why the United States has taken the stand it has with Huawei and, on a broader stand, China.
Some people say that this whole effort is part of basically a negotiating gambit on the part of Trump, right? He's trying to put pressure on the Chinese. The trade dispute is worsening. Their negotiations have basically fallen through, and they're trying to get them going again. Trump is looking for greater leverage, the argument goes, and here's Huawei. This is a real source of leverage for him in trying to get the Chinese to agree to his trade goals. And if they do agree, then maybe he will relent. If you're talking about the U.S. position on this, it's partly an issue of the kind of access that Huawei could get to the U.S. internet system to be used for either spying or to damage the U.S. internet system because of the very wide use of Huawei devices and hardware. But I think it goes even beyond that. I mean, it really goes to the question of, is the United States going to try to insulate China or isolate China and its telecommunications and its electronics from itself and from the Western world? Is it trying to reinforce the idea of a electronic wall, if you will, in which you have two separate operating systems in the world, one of which is basically Chinese-oriented and the other one is Western-oriented or Western-allied-oriented?
Doesn't the decision by the United States to block our Huawei in any way it's seemingly possible foster that, basically forcing the Chinese to come up with their own ways to complete their system?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it's doing. I mean, this is part of the dilemma that the United States is in. Huawei relies a lot on American chips. It is not as sophisticated a producer. And China in general isn't, as I understand it. I'm not an insider on this, but I've talked to people who do know a lot about it. And there's a lot of supply dependency on the part of Huawei on U.S. manufactured chips and other hardware. And this action by the United States, if it follows through on it, will provide increased motivation for the Chinese to, in fact, separate that dependency and develop their own chips. Now, the question there is, of course, how long would it take for them to do that? And would Huawei remain viable as a company over the period of time in which it's trying to really reduce its dependency on U.S. suppliers? And some people say it can be done in relatively short order, and other people say, no, it will take years to happen. And in the meantime, Huawei could be in jeopardy of actually surviving as a corporation.
Well, apparently what has happened with the decision by Google to pull out, although it apparently has not been doing business with Huawei in China for a while, this just hurts Huawei's customers in China, not around the world, and will hurt their business worldwide rather than in China in both ways. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of its devices that are used in China are also dependent upon U.S. suppliers. And one other big issue here is European companies, as I understand it, are more dependent upon or utilizing Huawei hardware than in the United States. In the United States, apparently, Huawei is a supplier in rural areas of the U.S. for internet devices of various types, routers and that sort of thing. In Europe, though, I think the dependency and the distribution there is much greater. So the question there, I mean, you've already seen Europeans have tried to basically adopt a middle ground on dealing with Huawei. The UK, for example, is putting the Huawei systems through an examination in which they're trying to seal off certain parts of Huawei from the UK government and then permit Huawei to operate in other areas. With this recent action by the United States to put Huawei on the so-called entity list of national security concerns or threats, it basically is trying to prohibit American companies overall from dealing with Huawei. It's not just U.S. government entities, which is the previous decision that the U.S. had made. It's now extended to U.S. companies writ large, civilian companies.
What has this done and what might this do in the future to U.S.-China relationships?
The United States now has identified China as essentially an existential threat. It's a threat to the global order from the U.S. position. It's a threat to American interests and American security. And it's a revisionist world power put in the same basic category as Russia and Iran. And it's now being treated increasingly as if that is the case. So people are trying to the U.S. is trying to discourage other countries from being involved with China in the Belt and Road Initiative, for example. It proposes this notion of debt trap diplomacy, that China is deliberately trying to draw countries into debt in order to get them to give over some of their infrastructure to China, which has very little evidence that that is actually the case. But I mean, you have this kind of escalating zero-sum approach on the part of the United States. And of course, China now is now moving in the same direction to some degree. It has not done so until now. But now with the latest escalation of the trade war, there are indications that the Chinese propaganda apparatus and the Chinese government and Chinese citizens are now moving in more of a direction of looking at the United States as an enemy, in a sense.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with Michael Swain, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now if you go to voanews.com online. Huawei founder shrugs off U.S. blacklisting order. Joko Widodo re-elected Indonesian president. Suspect in New Zealand mosque shootings charged with terrorism. French drug smuggler sentenced to death in Indonesia. U.S. sanctions on Huawei bite, but who gets hurt? You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A recovery team has entered a coal mine in New Zealand for the first time since 29 workers were killed in an explosion in 2010. Families of the victims are witnessing the symbolic re-entry of the Pike River mine. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports any evidence pointing to what caused the explosion will be handed to the police.
29 men died after an explosion at the Pike River mine in November 2010. The victims' bodies have never been brought out. The Pike River Recovery Agency said families of the men cheered as a team of specialists returned from the mine, having been inside for the first time since the tragedy almost 9 years ago. Many months of work lie ahead for the recovery experts. Tuesday's re-entry was a low-key event for families after they'd requested privacy. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
We've, on the request of the families, really left it to the agency to announce and then manage the point at which they remove that final piece of concrete which symbolises re-entry into the drift. That's something we've left them to manage. At families' request, it won't be a public event, but one where families will certainly be kept informed. But that symbolic re-entry, I think it's appropriate we leave that with the families.
It's taken the Pike River Recovery Agency a year to prepare for re-entry. It's cut through a concrete seal that closed the mine following the 2010 disaster and also ventilating an access tunnel. Previous missions to go back into the South Island mine have been delayed. 2 weeks ago, the most recent attempt was aborted after unusual levels of oxygen were detected. The New Zealand government is reportedly spending $23.5 million to re-enter the mine and investigate what happened on that terrible day. Bereaved relatives had been told by the previous government that it was too dangerous to try to return to retrieve the miners' bodies. An inquiry found that safety systems at the facility were inadequate and reports of excessive methane gas levels were not heeded. Most of the victims were New Zealanders, along with others from Australia and Britain. The youngest miner to die was Joseph Dunbar. He had turned 17 the day before the tragedy and was killed on his first shift working underground. The mining disaster in 2010 was New Zealand's worst in almost a century. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now regarding Asia, more than 170 American shoe manufacturers and retailers, including such well-known athletic shoe brands as Nike, Under Armour, and Adidas, have urged President Donald Trump to exempt footwear from any further tariffs he imposes on imported goods from China. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia, and we want to keep you updated on some U.S. political developments. Democratic lawmakers say the Trump administration's refusal to provide additional information and testimony relating to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report has plunged the United States into a constitutional crisis. The fight over just how much oversight the U.S. Congress should have over the White House has triggered a debate about the balance of power in the U.S. government. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Capitol Hill.
Congress is a check on the White House, often sparking confrontation between the two.
The administration has decided that they are not going to honor their oath of office.
A confrontation about congressional oversight that Democratic lawmakers say has now crossed the line into something much more serious.
We are now in it. We are now in a constitutional crisis.
But the U.S. Constitution is vague about the balance of power between the two branches of government, leaving voters wondering.
There's some kind of crisis, for sure. I can't say exactly whether it would qualify as a constitutional crisis or not.
Trump has tested the limits of presidential power before, declaring a national emergency after Congress refused to pay for a U.S.-Mexico border wall. But in a tweet, he said Democrats are the problem, a view supported by his own party.
The only crisis we have is the majority of this Congress.
66% of American voters in a recent Quinnipiac University poll said House Democrats should not impeach the president.
I think it's much ado about nothing. I personally think that the when whoever's in power squeals loudly about the other side, you know, it came from the one side, now it's the other.
The system of government set up by the Constitution has been challenged before. When Richard Nixon resigned rather than face impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors, and earlier, when confrontation between free and slave-owning states started the Civil War. In the case of subpoenas for the Trump administration, scholars say Congress has wide authority.
The president may assert executive privilege. This is something I predicted about 5 months ago when the Congress shifted hands. Presidents do assert executive privilege, but the Supreme Court has indicated that it's fairly narrow.
The third branch of government, the judiciary, could provide clarity.
The real constitutional crisis will be is if a federal judge orders that the president or people working for the president or private parties are ordered to produce the materials after a full hearing, and the president orders people not to do it.
A refusal that could change the minds of voters.
It's dividing our country so deeply, and if some transparency could shed light on everything that's in there, and perhaps we can move forward.
Who say they just want to see a working government. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Coming up, a coffee war brews in China. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says India is among a handful of countries set to benefit from the U.S.-China trade dispute. While China is buying more agricultural products from India, the United States is buying chemicals, pharmaceuticals, jewelry, auto components, and apparel. Find a wealth of stories for free at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China brews a new cup of coffee while getting new luxury cars, as we hear in today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Luckin Coffee is quickly becoming the go-to caffeine boost in traditionally tea-drinking China. Established in October of 2017, Luckin Coffee has become the second-largest coffee chain store in China after Starbucks. With its larger stores and higher prices, Starbucks coffee has traditionally appealed to the upper middle class in China. Luckin Coffee has a lower price point and a proactive discount and coupon program that has appealed to a large segment of Chinese consumers who appreciate value. Luckin also offers an efficient pickup and delivery service business model that has spread quickly through the use of its mobile app. Starbucks has now teamed up with Alibaba to launch its own coffee delivery service, but it hasn't done so as quickly as its rival. Luckin Coffee recently went public on the Nasdaq, with shares finishing the first day of trading up nearly 20% from the initial public offering of $17 a share. The company is now valued at over $10 billion and hopes to live up to its name, meaning happiness and luck, by turning around losses of more than $241 million in 2017 and $82 million last year. Luckin now has almost 2,400 stores in 28 cities. It wants to open 2,000 additional stores in the country by the end of the year. Starbucks also says it will be opening more stores, aiming to open around 600 a year. Google's parent company, Alphabet, has suspended some business with Huawei, a major blow to the Chinese tech company that the U.S. government has sought to blacklist. Huawei Technologies is one of the biggest global makers of network equipment for phone and internet companies and has been at the center of the U.S.-Chinese tensions over cyberspying. The latest suspension of services means Huawei will lose access to updates on the Android operating system, and the next version of its smartphones outside of China will also lose access to applications, including Google Play Store and Gmail. Alphabet's restrictions come shortly after U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order blocking U.S. companies from doing business with foreign tech companies that pose a, quote, unacceptable risk to the national security of the United States. The U.S. blacklist of Huawei could make it difficult for the company to compete in the global smartphone market and could affect China's ability to build 5G networks in the future. 5G is the next generation of mobile telecommunications and will be up to 100 times faster than the current 4G platforms. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Authorities in New Zealand have charged the self-avowed white supremacist who killed 51 worshippers at two Christchurch mosques back in March with terrorism. Prosecutors also charged him with an additional count of murder over a worshipper who died in a hospital earlier this month. All the big stories came your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, extreme weather and rising sea levels are putting pressure on the natural world and on the infrastructure we've put in place to manage wastewater. Rebuilding aging infrastructure is expensive, so National Science Foundation research is teaching old infrastructure new tricks to handle new problems. The new story comes courtesy of VOA's Kevin Enix.
It is time to release some water from this detention pond in Ann Arbor, Michigan. With a few taps on a smartphone, these two 12-inch valves open up. Managing ponds like this is necessary because more people and more buildings are straining the system.
We're in an urban environment. We're kind of boxed in. We don't have room to make the pond bigger. What we need is something innovative and different to make the pond function differently.
With support from the National Science Foundation, Bronco Kirkes and a team at the University of Michigan are building a new generation of smart and connected stormwater systems.
That's kind of the vision behind this, is instead of new construction, what you're able to do is take your existing system, retrofit it with these autonomous technologies, and effectively squeeze more out of it.
They start by deploying wireless sensors in a watershed. The sensors report back data like water levels and flow rates.
So the green nodes indicate that the sensors are operating well and they're sending us real-time data.
Algorithms sort through the information and route stormwater through the system to prevent flooding.
So I'm actually analyzing the data that these sensors provide us. So looking at the data, seeing how the network itself is operating, and then using that data in a control algorithm to tell us how those assets should be controlled, how a gate should open, how a pump should be set.
The sensors also test for water quality. Ponds and wetlands are home to microbes that can break down pollutants.
So a lot of stormwater systems aren't just designed for flooding. They're also designed for water quality. What you want to do is you want to treat that water and hold it back during these storm events to effectively remove the pollutants that are in that water.
Kirkes likens this effort to building a self-driving car.
What if you not necessarily took the human out of the loop, but you helped the human make better decisions, and ultimately once trust builds over time into this autonomous system, then you might have something like a self-driving car one day, but for water systems.
For Evan Pratt, this partnership has been win-win.
For me to replace this infrastructure would cost millions of dollars. But for just $25,000, we found a way to squeeze 33% better performance on pollutant loading out of it.
Building smart stormwater systems to handle rising waters. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain some appearance differences on the moon.
This is Science in a Minute.
The moon has two faces, the near and the far side, with each side looking much different from the other. The near side, always facing toward us, features a number of dark areas called marias across its surface. The far side doesn't have as many of these marias, but is much more heavily cratered. Scientists have found that the far side's crust is also thicker than the near side of the moon. A new study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets, suggests a reason for these differences. Using data from NASA's GRAIL mission, the researchers found evidence that a celestial body between 720 and 780 kilometers in diameter collided with the moon's near side during the early history of the solar system. The researchers theorized the impact blew away material from the moon's near side and buried the crust of the far side under about 5 to 10 kilometers of debris. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We say hello to people who have heard our program on CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks for listening to us today. You can also catch us on iTunes and SoundCloud, of course, on VOA Asia Facebook. and our website at voanews.com. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Cedric Franklin, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.